The following is a paid program. The opinions contained within do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or sponsors of News Talk Radio WOBM AM 1160 and 1310.
Inside the Law is presented to educate listeners in Monmouth and Ocean counties about legal issues. The opinions expressed by the host, guests, and phone callers are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Town Square Media and are not intended to be a substitute for personal legal advice from your own attorney.
Your questions and comments are welcome at 732-505-1160. Inside the Law, talk radio for the Jersey Shore.
Good morning, Monmouth and Ocean County. This is Jason Wyatt from the law firm Novi & Associates, and you're listening to Inside the Law on 1160 WOBM AM and 1310 AM in Monmouth County. You know the format. Every other week, we take you inside the law on a topic of interest to, hopefully of interest to our listening public. Novi & Associates, my employer and the law firm where I work, is a law firm that specializes in an area known as elder law. That includes assisting clients with estate planning, the preparation of wills, powers of attorney, trusts, and living wills, as well as adult Medicaid, asset protection, guardianships, settling estates and trusts, as well as real estate. And I'm emphasizing the word trusts in today's intro because that is part of our topic today. Today is the third installment in our series on fiduciaries, and we're going to explain what that means in a minute, but we have had the last two shows on different types of fiduciaries. Today's type of fiduciary focuses on trustees, and our guest today is Novi & Associates' very own Jake Mason. Good morning, Jake.
Morning, Jason. How are you today?
I am excellent. Beautiful day out there, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Good. It's a good day for all of you who haven't done your ALS ice bucket challenge to do so, because it's going to be nice and warm and sunny.
Or to golf.
Jake's going to be interviewing me regarding today's topic, which is trustees, and we're going to try to cover it in a broad sort of way, because a lot of people don't have a good idea of what a trustee is or what a trust is, for that matter. I find that my clients tend to have a good concept, understanding of what an estate is, and especially what an executor. They've heard that word before, and they know what a will is, thanks to Hollywood. You know, they have these movies and TV shows where somebody passes away, and they have a reading of the will at the lawyer's office, and sometimes they wheel out the video. You know, the person reads what they want from beyond the grave. So people have an idea of what a will is and what an executor does to a higher degree than they do, I think, for trusts and trustees. So that's what we're going to focus on today. If you have any questions, we're live this morning, so give us a call at 732-505-1160. Again, 732-505-1160. Whether it's related to trusts and trustees or not, we're happy to answer, at least try to answer, any questions that you have out there from the listening public. So I guess, Jake, you want to take it away and start the interview?
Sure, Jason. Thanks. So my first question for you is, what advice do clients need when naming a trustee, and what questions are commonly asked?
Well, actually, a precursor to that question probably is, once you've decided you need a trust, then what kind of advice do they look for in naming a trustee? So let me first start to answer the question by just explaining why somebody might need a trust. And just to let you know out there as our listening public, we've done shows on the different types of trusts in the past, and so I encourage you, if you want more of an in-depth review of this concept, to go to novilaw.com, that's NOVYLAW.com, and look at our log of past shows and look for that one on the types of trusts that exist, because you get a full hour there and pretty in-depth review of the type of common types of trust that we create in our office in helping clients do estate and Medicaid planning, as well as disability and asset protection planning. But just quickly, there's a couple of different types. One common type is called a revocable living trust, and that word revocable is very important because it means that the whole trust can be revoked at any time by the person creating the trust. It's almost a non-entity for a lot of purposes, but one key place where it is a respected entity is when somebody dies, having created a revocable trust, it helps their estate avoid probate. That can be a very positive thing, especially if you're in some of the other states in this country that have probate laws that are not so user-friendly. New Jersey is one of the better, if not the best, state when it comes to the ease and expense of probate being not too difficult and not too expensive. So we don't use them as commonly in New Jersey as some lawyers do in other states, but we still use them sometimes because avoiding probate can be a benefit to a family. For instance, if they don't want the directions in the will to be of public record, because probate is of public record. It can also be useful if you own real estate in more than one state so that you can avoid having to probate a will over and over and over again in different states. And there are other uses for it, too, as well. Sometimes people use it as they call it standby trust is another name for the same thing, and that's probably more descriptive of the last use that I'm going to talk about, which is planning for disability. The trust is on standby, owning assets so that if something happens to a person, especially as they age, there's a very streamlined continuity of management of those accounts where the trustee, usually a son or daughter, but could be anybody that they really are okay placing trust in, can come in and take over and pay bills and just manage assets, you know, keep real estate taxes paid, all the things that people might worry about that wouldn't get done if they didn't get a chance to or weren't able to continue to manage their own affairs. So that's one very common type of trust, revocable living trust, to avoid probate and sometimes to plan for your own incapacity if something were to go wrong and have a very streamlined, quick, and continuous form of management. There's another whole group of trusts which are irrevocable, which means once you make them, you can't change their terms. Sometimes you can appoint somebody else who can change their terms, like another family member, but the creator of them cannot change their terms. And these are usually done not to avoid probate or to help, you know, with continuity of management in a disability scenario, but rather either to try to achieve tax savings. And when I say tax, it could be estate tax, it could be inheritance tax, it could be income tax, it could be gift tax, a lot of different types of taxes that there are certain types of irrevocable trust designed to address. And the other one can be also to try to plan for Medicaid. Other states are a little bit more liberal in the type of trust that they will be allowed to exempt from Medicaid. New Jersey is much more strict, but they're still used from time to time. And they're fairly strict types of trusts. The third area of trusts are what we call testamentary trusts, and that name comes from the term last will and testament. So a testamentary trust is a trust that is created by a will. So it's kind of like a document within a document, or really it's a paragraph in your will. And there are a lot of different types of testamentary trusts. Sometimes you establish a testamentary trust for a beneficiary or even a contingent beneficiary who is, quote-unquote, too young. And we always find that age changes or has changed, let me put it that way, over the years. We used to use ages like 18 or 21 a lot. Now we see 25, 30, 35. So we call that a younger person's trust. They used to call it a minor's trust, but if you're 30 years old, you're not really a minor. So younger, I guess, is the right way to say it. That's one very common testamentary trust. There are also lots of testamentary trusts that might be created, again, to plan for most especially the estate tax. There are testamentary trusts that can be created if a beneficiary has kind of special issues, and there could be all sorts of different special issues. Sometimes it's a son or a daughter who you have, you know, as the person writing the will feel very, you know, good about. This is my son. I trust him. But I've got concerns about my daughter-in-law. I hear that constantly. We have a saying in our office that in-laws are great, but you got to be careful because in-laws can very quickly become outlaws. So we do a lot of trust planning inside people's wills to just kind of protect from a scenario where a son or daughter or anybody else, niece, nephew, whoever the beneficiary is, if they were to either get divorced after having inherited, or if they were themselves to pass away after having inherited. If you want to try to control those situations, one way to do that, and really the primary way to do that, is a testamentary trust. A third common type of testamentary trust is a trust for a beneficiary that has special needs. We see that often because a person with special needs of any different, there's lots of different types, but of any type may have, just practically speaking, trouble or inability to manage their own funds. Even if they can manage their own funds, like with a lot of physical disabilities, doesn't affect a person's ability to make economic decisions. There's a worry that if their physical or mental disability qualifies them for either public or private benefits, some of those programs have needs-based testing before you can qualify, which is to say that if you have a lot of your own money, you're not entitled to receive those benefits. So if they inherit money outright, that is to say in their name directly, it can disqualify them for benefits. Sometimes it can be used to pay either the government or a private entity back for years and years of benefits that have already been outlaid, and then all of a sudden a disabled person comes into money like this, and it might disqualify them for benefits. So sometimes if that's a scenario where either the inheritance is going to actually disqualify them or just go up in smoke because it's going to be used to pay back for benefits, we use a special needs trust to allow some other family member to be the trustee over those funds and expend them on behalf of the person with the disability, but in a manner that won't disqualify them for those benefits. So those are three very common types of testamentary trusts. We do also have versions of most of those trusts that sometimes people create during their lifetime, and that's oftentimes called an inter vivos trust, which I believe is Latin for during life. Special needs, inter vivos special needs trusts are very common. Sometimes when a person gets in a car accident or has had a disability resultant from medical malpractice, a court will award them an amount, you know, from a lawsuit that they win or settle. And that amount that's coming to them, oftentimes, and in this day and age, I think by court rule now has to be, or they have to advise at least, that it be placed into a special needs trust for the disabled person's benefit. And that's considered usually a self-settled trust, which means that the disabled person is creating the trust for themselves. And then the other one that happens sometimes is a child or a family member with a disability might have a trust created for them by a grandparent or a parent so that money can be gifted or put in trust for them during their lifetime. And again, it's with the same goal there, is to try to provide for their care without disqualifying them for benefits, if at all possible. We do a lot of charitable trust planning in our office, and there's a lot of different types of charitable trusts. Most of them focus on providing a benefit to both the charity and the person creating the trust. They can really be tax advantaged as well, in addition to being philanthropic. So that's an interesting type of area, and I believe we've done whole shows on that too, right, Jake?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so check out www.novilaw.com. Again, look for that show if you're interested in charitable planning. Sometimes it can be a really nice setup where you can provide a benefit to a charity, an income stream to yourself, and really not give up anything during your lifetime. The trust is what makes it work during your lifetime, and then at death, it kind of springs into action. And I think those are really the main types of trusts that most people focus on. So now that I spent a few minutes going over those, I want to step back and just say, no matter what type of trust you create, what you're creating is really, you start out with a document. Start off with a document, either a trust inside of a will or its own document, which is sets up the rules for the trust, and that's what the lawyer usually would write for you. And those rules are really what you, the details of the trust, you know, how it's run, who is it benefit, and then today's topic, which is who is the trustee, who's going to manage this entity once it's established, because that's what happens after you sign a trust document or after your will is probated and you include trust provisions in it. You have an entity that is kind of like a company in some ways. That's the best metaphor or parallel that I can draw, because it's not a human being, right? Just like a company, Microsoft's not a human being. But it is what we call a legal person. You know, it pays taxes or potentially could pay taxes. It can invest and own things. It can run businesses. It can, do almost anything a human being can do. But obviously it needs human beings to run it, you know. So the person who runs the trust, once it's established as an entity, is the trustee. And so if you carry through on my parallel to a company, it's kind of like the CEO or the president of the company. So they don't necessarily own it, although some CEOs own part of their company. The trust is its own owner of things. It's a legal entity that can own real estate. It can own stock. It can own bonds. It can own whatever. But the CEO manages it, you know, makes the decisions on what to do and what not to do. And so that's today's focus is the trustee. So, Jake, to your question, what advice do clients need when naming a trustee? I mean, usually they need everything we just went through. First of all, they need an education into what exactly a trustee does or is. And it's usually a question of, once I know why I'm establishing this trust and who is it benefiting, then I can give you advice on who the trustee should be. And it might depend on the family makeup. In a lot of families, they name family members. It might be a corporate trustee, and we're going to talk about these in more detail. But you know, it's a very difficult question to answer broadly because it really depends on the family and the type of trust in question. So I don't know if that's the best answer, but you know, that's you have to look at the situation. You know, it depends. The classic law school answer. It depends.
It depends. And I just want to remind everybody who's listening, Jason just gave out a ton of information. So we always encourage you to have a pen and pad handy to take notes. And if anybody has any questions about what we just covered, please give us a call at 732-505-1160. Again, that's a new number, semi-new number. I think it's about a month old now. Mm-hmm. But again, that number is 732-505-1160. Or give us a call at our office. We always take calls at our office at 732-657-0600, and we encourage you to call in.
Yeah, all the attorneys at Novena Associates are happy to take phone calls during the week and just answer general questions. If it's a complicated question, we may ask you to come in for a free consultation, but you know, we're not going to pick up the phone and send you a bill just for you know having a possible concern that you would want to see if you can get an answer to. And again, 732-505-1160. See what they did there with that, Jake? Very smart.
I did.
Easy to remember, new phone number if you have a question during today's show, or 732-657-0600 during the week. What if somebody doesn't want to call? They're a little bashful, Jake. What's the email address to send us a question over the computer?
Send us an email at info, that's I-N-F-O, at novilaw.com. Again, that's NOVYLAW.com.
And we're happy to address questions via email. In fact, you'll get a more lawyerly answer most of the time. I think we have a first call today. And you want to go ahead and take it now, Jake? Might as well, right?
Sure.
All right. Make sure I do this right. Oh, we're not ready for the call yet. Okay. So the question of who your trustee is, you know, it's a complicated one. And what you could consider when naming a trustee, you know, you've got to, if you're thinking about a family member, or a corporate trustee, and we're going to talk about both of those things. What you've got to consider sometimes, in my opinion, is the length of the trustee. I have too many clients that come in and they just say that they're going to name the same person as their executor. But the problem with that is that an executor usually serves, you know, the estate takes to administer an estate, as we call it, to get it from start to finish, takes 6 to 18 months for most estates, sometimes longer. But, you know, it's a maybe 2 or 3 year, you know, expenditure of time. And in the long run, that's pretty short compared to a lot of trusts, especially considering that an executor isn't working every day of the 2 to 3 years. It's just, you know, spotty work here and there. Whereas a trustee, imagine a trust that goes out to age 30, like in my example, and the person has a trust established for them when they're 2. You know, could be decades of service. So that's probably, to me, what clients gloss over the most when I'm thinking about a trustee. Is this the right entity or person, given how long this trust might exist? I think we're ready for a call now, Lauren. Good morning, August. How you doing? Hello?
Hello.
Good morning, August. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
On this beautiful morning, I am fantastic.
Oh, that's great. I was wondering if you can tell me, when you appoint a trustee, is there compensation for that? And if so, is there any tax on it?
That's a very good question. It's a very common one from my clients, which means I know that everybody who contemplates a trustee probably winds up thinking about it at some point. And the answer is that they are entitled to compensation. Later in the show, I'm going to go through in detail how you calculate that compensation. But the short answer is yes, absolutely they're entitled to compensation. If they decide to take it, it is income taxable, and they don't get to take extra because they have to pay income tax on it. They get the set amount according to New Jersey law, and then their tax is computed on that amount because they're getting paid for doing work. So it really is income. That's the definition of income. So the answer, August, is yes, they can take a commission, and yes, it is income taxable. That's a terrific question. Thank you for calling. Do you have any follow-up or...
No, thank you. It helps me greatly in planning my estate work.
Okay, terrific.
I appreciate your help.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, August. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I love when we get a call from August during August. That's terrific.
Is that irony? I don't know.
I don't know. It's
I'm
close.
Not sure, but
it's
it
close.
Might be.
It's close.
It might be.
So the question about, what advice do we give, that's probably the biggest piece that I look at the beginning is how long is a person going to serve? And then we start to focus on, well, what are they going to do? Who or what duties are they going to have? So hopefully that answered your question, Jake.
It did. And is it possible to also name yourself as a trustee?
That's a good question. People oftentimes want to, have their cake and eat it too, create the entity and get the benefit that comes with it. And keep in mind when you create a trust, I have clients that come in and they say, well, I booked the appointment because I'm pretty sure I want a trust. And I understand that sentiment, but, to the layperson, that makes sense. To the attorney, it's kind of like if you were a doctor and a patient came in and said, I've been thinking about it and I kind of decide I want a surgery. And the doctor's reply would usually be, well, for what? What ails you? What's going on? And usually the patient would say, well, for my knee hurts or whatever it is. But when we have that in the trust world, usually the client doesn't know. Well, my sister has one and she said it was a good idea. Or my neighbor just set one up and I think I want one. And it might be that that those clients need trusts of one or more type, but it also might not be. So a trust is really an ends to a mean. It's a way to solve a problem or try to achieve some sort of benefit. So it depends on what you're looking to do if you even create a trust at all. So whether or not you can name yourself as a trustee oftentimes centers on what type of ends to a mean we're trying to achieve. With a revocable living trust, for example, you absolutely can name yourself as trustee, and most people do, so they can continue to manage the assets in the revocable trust just as if they owned them themselves. So there's really no change day to day in the management of a checking account or a brokerage account or the piece of real estate. The benefit of a revocable living trust is that it's the same as owning it yourself during your lifetime, basically. But if you become disabled or when you pass away, it provides some benefits that might not be achieved otherwise. So you can name yourself as a trustee of a revocable living trust. A lot of the other types of trust, the answer, Jake, is no, especially the during life irrevocable trusts, because a lot of those trusts center around the idea that you, in order to achieve what we're trying to achieve, you have to give up some control. You have to make a completed transfer. And if you're basically making a gift to yourself, that's not really a gift. If you're really transferring ownership to yourself, that's not really a transfer. So a lot of those other trusts you cannot name yourself. And that's a big downside to a lot of clients. But, the good news is your spouse is not yourself. So sometimes people say, oh, well, I could name my wife or I can name my husband. That's not that different than naming myself. Fine. Or a child, if you have a trusted child, not everybody does. But there are some choices within the family for those types of trusts where people otherwise would want to retain control themselves. And even in more rare circumstances, sometimes not even a family member is appropriate, and you've got to look at a bank or other professional fiduciary. So hopefully that answered that question.
It does. And we talked a little bit about naming family members already. Is there anything else that you want to add on that?
Yeah,
on that
I think there's a little bit I do want to add on that. And just a reminder, everybody, you're listening live to Inside the Law on 1160 WOBM AM in Ocean County and on 1310 AM in Monmouth County. If you have any questions, you know, feel free to call in like August did, 732-505-1160, or give us a shout during the week at Novian Associates. We have offices in Manchester and Seagirt. Our main number is 732-657-0600, or shoot us an email at info@novilaw.com. And there are a lot of considerations you need to think about when naming a family trustee. Jake, you know, it's a kind of a question that I don't always know how I feel about it, because I am a strong believer in professional fiduciaries. They do a terrific job, but they do take a fee for that. So that's one thing to consider. Whereas a family trustee, while they, you know, a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister or whomever, might be entitled to a commission, and we're still going to talk about that, they oftentimes don't take them, because if you take a commission and you're the trustee, you know, if I'm the trustee for my cousin or my nephew, I'm taking money out of his pocket to pay myself. And as I do that, I'm letting New Jersey and the federal government take a bite in income taxes. So it's kind of like as a family, we make out worse if I take the commission, even though I make out a little better because I'm the trustee. I got a little extra cash in my pocket. Whereas if I just leave it in the trust, there's more money there for us as a family, even though I don't have use of it. I have more there for my nephew, so to speak, or for my cousin. And so it's sometimes a question of, well, am I okay with the commissions being paid out of this or not? Because if all things being equal, there's going to be commissions taken in under both scenarios, you know, I would probably say most of the time I would advise against a family trustee. Not always, but most of the time. On the other hand, the other things you got to look at if you decide you do want a family trustee, maybe because of the commission issue, is can the person or people that I'm naming, can they handle this? You know, if a person is, not great with paperwork, if they're pretty disorganized, if deadlines are a challenge to them, that's probably not the best person to be the trustee, because sometimes there is paperwork to do. If there's tax returns to be filed, there might be deadlines you got to address. You know, so you got to look at the family members who are in place, so to speak, and see, do any of these people really make sense? You know, and sometimes somebody who might be able to handle being an executor, which is, I think, a slightly less complicated job in some ways, might not be able to be a trustee. But on the other hand, somebody who can handle an executorship, especially for any estate that has a decent amount of assets in it, you know, it's actually in some ways very similar. And by the way, we said fiduciaries at the beginning of the show. A fiduciary really is just anybody who manages assets that aren't their own. So a trustee managing assets for another family member is a fiduciary. An executor who has to take care of the estate assets is a fiduciary. A guardian, you know, if somebody's disabled and they have to have a legal guardian, or if they're underage, that's another type of fiduciary. Even a power of attorney is often considered a fiduciary. So just to rewind there a little bit, but you know, naming a family member has to be something you carefully consider. You can't just do it willy-nilly. Sometimes I tell clients, especially for the simpler types of trusts, Jake, that you can name even a person who is, quote-unquote, not very sophisticated. You know, if you're an accountant, then I think you probably can handle being a trustee. But what about a person who is a bus driver? Can they handle being a trustee? And my question to that client is, they might be able to. You know, the pointed question I say is, are they the type of person who would look at this and say, I think I understand it, but let me ask some questions of a professional? Would they eventually talk to an accountant, talk to a banker, talk to a financial advisor, talk to a lawyer? And if they're the type of person who you think would get themselves in front of those professionals for a little bit of advice, then they probably can handle being a trustee of a lot of types of trusts. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. On the other hand, if it's just not, you know, if there's nobody in the family that has that in their wheelhouse, then you've got to look at a corporate trustee. So hopefully that answers that question, Jake.
Absolutely. And we talked about naming adult children responsible enough to handle being a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
At what age do you find those children responsible.
Right. It, most commonly, when people are talking about family trustees, they're looking at a child in the long run, you know, when the second parent passes away usually. And that may be even if they aren't including grandkids in their estate plan, or could be nieces and nephews and great nieces and nephews or whomever primarily. But we usually wind up including in one way, shape, or form that next younger generation as a backup. You know, if I've got a couple kids and one of them dies at the same time as me or before me, then usually I'm going to include their children as the backup beneficiary for them. And clients don't often think about that. It's not a nice thing to think about. Well, what happens if my son or daughter dies before me or at the same time as me? But it's one of our jobs as a lawyer to make them think about it and address the question. And if it were to happen, whether they're a primary beneficiary or a backup contingent beneficiary, like I just explained, the question then becomes, well, if I've got these little grandkids, and I use the word little, you know, in quotes, because that could be a 15, 20, 25-year-old grandkid, may not be little at all in terms of height, but maturity-wise, if I've got these younger people who might be inheriting a share of my estate, if I want to keep it within the family and I have somebody who might be able to serve, it might be, well, are they old enough yet? You know, if I've got two 20-something kids and one of them has a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, am I comfortable if that parent dies with that aunt or uncle, you know, who's 26, managing 6, sometimes 7, 5, 6, 7 figures, maybe more of assets for these little people, you know, these little kids, these little grandkids. And so the answer, what age do people become responsible enough to be a trustee? It's actually pretty similar to what age they become responsible enough to inherit. And a lot of times we focus on those two questions together. And that varies from client to client. And I think I've been saying ages like 25 and 30. Those are probably the most common. And I'd probably say that if somebody's old enough to inherit outright, then they're probably old enough to be a trustee if they otherwise have the skill set. If it's a person that you're leaving money in trust to, then it doesn't make sense to also name them as a trustee. So I don't know, probably somewhere around the age of 30 plus or minus 5 years. That's probably my guess. I like that 30, 35 age because I see, you know, we see clients that have kids and grandkids in their early 20s and they're not very mature. But by age 30, they're quite mature. And Jake just threw his hands up because Jake's 24, 25, Jake's 25. Right in that range. But you know, Jake might be an example of a more mature person in their mid-20s.
Good rebound there.
But there are people out there who are not mature. On the other hand, if you use an age like 30 or 35 and you say, well, that's maybe a little young, and you're thinking about 40 or 45, you know, my argument with that, and we do it all the time, but my argument on that front is, well, if you're not mature at 35, is making somebody wait to be a trustee or to inherit, whichever question you're answering, is making them wait until they're 40 or 45, is that really going to make a difference? Or if somebody's immature and can't do this kind of stuff at 35, might we guess that might be a permanent sort of situation? You know, that might be a person who's just never going to quite get there. I call it the sink or swim age. You know, if you haven't gotten to that point by 35, if you haven't sunk or swim, then you're probably not going to learn to swim. You're sinking. And so it's an interesting question because it's hard for us to address sometimes as a lawyer because we're sitting there with the client and they're describing their kids or grandkids to us and we're making our best guess. It's not like we get a chance to interview them and say, you know, give them a test, you know, the trustee test. Did you pass? Could you handle this kind of stuff? But ultimately it comes down to the client's decision. What's old enough? But I think that those mid 30, 30, 25, 30, 35 sort of age range is the most likely answer.
And we see a lot of clients, too, that talk about or have already named distant relatives as trustees.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend that? And are there certain cases where that is recommended, certain cases where it isn't recommended? Is it something that's cut and dry?
Right.
What are your thoughts on distant relatives as trustees?
If it's a distant relatives in terms of blood, but the emotional relationship is pretty close, you know, you happen to have a second cousin who is just like your brother or, you know, who's just like another grandkid or something like that, then usually would say, go ahead, you know, especially if you think they're willing to serve and they're a good candidate. On the other hand, you know, if it's a distant relative you don't know that well, it might not be the best idea. And one thing that you want to look at sometimes is the relationship not between you and the trustee when you're creating a trust or under a will, But actually the relationship between whoever the beneficiary is going to be and that trustee. You know, if I'm naming a trustee for my child and I've got a great relationship with my second cousin because we grew up together, but my son has only met him twice, you know, that might not be the best situation. I might want to name somebody who my son is a little bit more familiar with. So that's one thing to look at. And you know, so it's a hard question to answer. There's no yes or no. Most of the time I would say don't just name somebody to keep it in the family. You know, you're better off paying a professional. But it can work, you know. Sometimes people say, you know, I know my cousin fairly well, although I don't see him every day. I see him once or twice a year, and he's got a law degree or he's got a, you know, MBA or, you know, some credential that makes you think that they probably would be able to, you know, handle the administration of the trust, and he's got a decent relationship or she's got a decent relationship with the beneficiary in question. Yeah, I don't shy away from it either. One thing that goes with that question, though, Jake, is oftentimes clients will ask me, well, should I tell these people that they're being named? And if it's a trust that you're creating during your lifetime to put into action right away, then you got to tell them, because otherwise the trust won't function. It'll be like a company with no CEO, or a CEO doesn't know he's a CEO. Or she's the CEO. But if it's a trust that's going to take or really become active some later date, like when somebody passes away or upon the occurrence of some future event, like somebody becomes disabled, then it's a kind of a more tougher question. Do you tell a potential trustee that they are the trustee? Sometimes I would say yes, sometimes I would say no, probably more often the latter, because you never know, you could change your mind, especially for a will or a revocable trust where you retain the right to modify its terms going forward. You might want to refrain from that, because who knows, maybe, you know, if you've named a nephew as a trustee and then it turns out the kids themselves in their 30s show that they're perfectly mature of being trustees, one of them dies, that, you know, they can be trustee for their own nieces and nephews. You don't have to name their cousin, whatever the situation might be. You know, you make it hard on yourself if you've told everybody details of your plan. And that goes for any detail in the plan, from who the beneficiary is to who an executor is under will, to who a trustee is under a trust document, to what percentage they're receiving, to who gets what item. You know, you got to be careful how much you share, because every time you share, you create expectations, let's put it that way. So when you name a more distant relative, maybe they're going to look at that situation, and if you tell them about it and then they're not serving, they might get disappointed. They might, you know, have the motivation to create a lawsuit. So it's a tough question, but sometimes and not infrequently, we do name cousins and nephews and things like that as trustees. Yes, absolutely.
And when naming any sort of family member as trustee, we already kind of briefly answered August question about taking fees. What types of fees are family members entitled to?
You can always create a fee structure in a document, first of all. But if that fee structure is something like, and I've seen this in documents, you know, I direct that my trustee shall not take a commission. Well, guess what? That's not enforceable, because slavery ended in this country in 1863. You can't force somebody to do something for free. By statute, they're entitled to take a commission. So if the fee structure you put in place pays them less than what they would receive under the default New Jersey law, then they can't take it. If you don't put anything in there, or if you don't put anything more than the commission in there, then they're entitled to take that commission. And it's calculated kind of interestingly. You have a calculator over there, Jake?
I can pull out my phone.
Why don't you pull one up on your phone? Because I'm going to go through the law, and maybe, Jake, you can run some numbers on what size these commissions are. Because I think a lot of times when you run the numbers, they're actually much lower than people think they would be. And there's one set of commissions for executors and other fiduciaries, and there's a second set of commissions for trustees. So I'm going to read the trustee commissions, because I think we've already addressed in an earlier show what executors can take. So I'm looking at, if you're a legal nerd and you want to look up the statute, it's New Jersey Statutes Annotated Title 3B, Chapter 18, Paragraph 20, Article 4, Paragraphs 23 through, 18-23 through 33. But the most important ones are, first, there's an income commission. And income is an interesting word, because it's used in all different areas of the law. Most people are familiar with it in terms of income tax, right? So some things for tax purposes are income and some things are not. But in a trust world, there's this whole type of accounting called trust accounting that is, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but not everything is income. Let's just leave it at that for now. But whatever is income, a lot of times it'd be things like dividends and interest that's earned on investment, stuff like that. The commissions are basically 6% of what is received by the trust during the year. So let's run some numbers. You have a $1 million trust, let's say. That's a pretty big trust. And it's invested conservatively in the market, right? What do you think a good rate of return would be over the years on a conservatively invested trust?
Conservatively?
Yeah.
What, 4 to 6%?
Yeah, 5 is usually the baseline number we use for estimates. There are certainly years past where 5 would be a very good rate of return. There are also years where that would be kind of low. So I like it as a rule of thumb sort of rate of return, especially on an investment the size of $1 million. Usually you can get decent rate of return. Takes money to make money. So 5% of $1 million is...
$50,000.
Exactly. And what is 6% of $50,000, Jake?
Now I got to bust out the calculator.
There you go.
$3,000.
So that would mean that for a $1 million trust, all the work the trustee does during the year, $1 million, the trustee would receive a grand total commission of $3,000. So you can see that that's – and what is $3,000 over $1 million? That's like 0.03%.
Percentage-wise, probably.
Yeah, less than 1%. So it's really a very small commission when you think about it in terms of what can be taken on the income. A trustee under a will or a non-testamentary trustee also is entitled to take corpus commissions. So here's where you add on a little bit more, but I still think that it's pretty low. So the next set of commissions that can be taken without court allowance for a trustee on the corpus, on the nest egg, so to speak, is $5 per $1,000 of corpus on the first $400,000. Okay, so we're going to do some math, right? How many times does $1,000 go into $400,000?
400 times.
And how many times does 5 go into 400?
80?
You use a calculator.
80, right?
All right. So it would be, let's see if we did that.
80.
Right. No, I think it would be 800. 400,000.
So, 400,000?
Yeah, 400,000.
Oh.
400,000.
Excuse me.
Divided by 1,000. We went to law school, folks, not math school.
I didn't go to law school.
Well, I did.
One of us did. Not math school.
Right. Hold on. 400. 1, 2, 3. Divided by 1,000. 400 times $5. $2,000. Okay. So a $400,000 trust would have $2,000 of corpus commission a year. Then after that, it's $3 for every 1,000. So let's go back to our example of the $1 million trust, right? So we know that it's $3,000 if it earns 5% a year. That's the first part of the commission. Then we know the first $400,000 has a corpus commission of $2,000. The next $600,000 would be 600. That's 600 thousands times $3 per the 1,000. So that's another $1,800. So if you add all those up, you get $6,800 for 1 year's worth of work on a $1 million trust. Okay, so that's, to me, not a lot of money considering the size of that trust. And as a percentage of the trust, that's way less than 1%. It's not even close to 1%. 1% of a $1 million trust would be $10,000. So there's... less than 1%. It's a, I guess, 0.068% of a percentage point. So you're not talking about a lot of commissions most of the time, and people sometimes will shy away from naming a trustee at all, a family trustee, or even creating a trust because they're worried about the commissions. But to me, if you're paying the trustee less than 1% a year. And let's go back to the example where the trust makes 5%, even 4 or 3%. You're still making money. It's still growing, snowballing, getting bigger. So, you know, you got to look at that. You can't let those commissions be the you know, forest for the trees that you're not seeing, because they do, in my opinion, not adequately compensate trustees for their service. And that's a very, very common question. It scares a lot of people from naming trustees, especially naming professional trustees who want a bigger commission, usually about 1%, by the way, for a professional trustee, give or take. So even a 1% fee, which would be like $10,000 on a $1 million trust, is, to me, fairly low considering the size of the trust and considering the fact that professional trustees usually do better than family members in terms of rate of return because they're professionals. They usually get pretty good rates of return, and you're coming out ahead compared to a family trustee, even a family trustee who takes 0% commission. So that's a kind of a detailed answer, but I wanted to do the example of the $1 million trust so everybody could see how low the commissions are.
And now, Jason, we talked a lot about, we focused a lot in the first 50 minutes of the show on family members.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 10 minutes, and I know it's going to be tough to keep this brief, but can we talk about some different professionals that are fit to serve and the reasons why you might name said professionals?
Absolutely. We've touched on that, and Jake's right. You know, it's always hard for a lawyer to keep anything brief, but they call what we write briefs, but that's really a bad name because they're usually not very brief.
I think that's irony.
That probably is irony. But the idea is, if I don't want to name a family member, or if Jason has convinced me and Jake has convinced me by running through some of the numbers that the commissions that even a family member can take are so low that why not just pay a professional a little bit extra to manage it and not have to worry about the things that I worry about with, you know, unsophisticated or non-professional trustees, kids who may not be awesome at being trustees, when I can name a professional. The question is, well, what do you mean by professional? Are there professional trustees out there? And actually, the answer is yes, there are. A lot of banks in this state have a, I don't know what you call it, subsidiary or a wing of the bank that basically just does exactly this. All they do is serve as professional trustees and fiduciaries. There are a lot of good ones in the state. There are also a lot of banks that don't have them. So don't assume that just because you have a checking or savings account somewhere or a brokerage account somewhere that they have trust services. But a lot of them do. And we work with them all the time. A lot of good ones out there. And that's probably the first place you look. The biggest problem with bank trustees is not that they take a commission. That's usually what people think. The commission, like I said, is usually going to be about 1%. It's not going to be killer when they're getting you 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% in rate of return. But it's actually that a lot of them have minimums. So if you don't have a super big trust or group of trusts for them to manage, because they will add them all together. If you give them, you know, 3 grandkids trust to manage, they'll count those numbers together. But if you don't have a super big trust for them to manage, they may politely decline to serve. So that's sometimes the biggest downside to those professional trustees when it comes to a bank. So then it becomes, well, who else is available? What about my accountant? What about my lawyer? What about my financial advisor? And all of those people might be able to serve. And again, they're professionals who are going to charge fees, and each one has slightly different fee structures. Lawyers and accountants tend to bill hourly. Financial advisors sometimes bill on the transactional basis per trade. Other times they do it as a percentage of assets managed. But it's a really case-by-case situation. I know there are lawyers out there who hate and refuse to become trustees. There are other lawyers who like doing it. I place myself somewhere in the middle. I don't want to do it for a family that has enough money to hire a bank, or for a family that has some people in the family who could do it. But if you're in a situation where neither of those apply, you know, I'm willing to be a trustee, knowing that I'm always going to hire a professional money manager, financial advisor to manage the account. I'm not going to pick stocks and things like that. Certainly not my, believe me, if you've seen some of the investment decisions I've made, it's not my forte at all. But I'm certainly capable of, you know, addressing the needs of a beneficiary. You know, here's a check for college. No, I will not buy you a Ferrari. Come back to me when you have a nice used Honda picked out. You know, those are the kind of things you hope that a trustee makes good decisions about. So your lawyer certainly can serve. I know some accountants are reluctant to serve. It depends on the accountant, just like it depends on the lawyer. I don't mean to stereotype accountants, but there is some degree to which the stereotype of a kind of a nerdy, introverted accountant is true. Not all of them, but some of them just don't like the idea of in the field work, of having to go visit a trustee in a hospital, at a facility, you know, something like that, or you know, they don't have that type of personal relationship with their you know, their clients' kids and things like that. Others, on the other hand, I've had some trustees who were, you know, for clients who were accountants that were absolutely phenomenal. So it's something you got to talk to your accountant about absolutely in advance. And again, you always got to look at the age difference. You got to look at, you know, my accountant's 75 and my grandkids are 15. It doesn't really make sense to name that person as a trustee. Do we have another call, Lauren? I think we have another call. We might be able to squeeze it in. We're going to try. The last person that some people look at is their financial advisor. And that's pretty rare that you'll find a financial advisor who can serve. It really would depend on their situation. Who are they working for? Do they have the ability to make trades? If so, who is their, you know, how are they making those trades? Most of the time, they're not going to be able to serve by SEC and FINRA rule. So you have to talk to your financial advisor, but you're usually not going to be able to set it up so that your financial advisor can serve. And those are usually the three players: lawyers, accountants, and financial advisors. Lauren, do we have a call? Sure. Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I got a question. I know your time is very precious right now. We're going to go off the air, but if you have a very, very large Roth account, is from an investment point of view now, putting that into a trust account so that when you do have profits and things, you don't have to come under the basic rules of 6 months or a year's for long-term gains. You could, you know, sell or buy at any time, and you don't have to worry about profits.
It depends sort of question, Tony. There are certainly some trusts that will have different rules when it comes to tax reporting, especially capital gains, which is primarily what you're talking about. Especially in the charitable world, there's a lot of ways to wipe out capital gains using certain types of charitable trusts, which still allow you. It's not like you're giving the money away. You still can get income streams coming back to you from those trusts. That may be what you're talking about.
No, I'm not really interested in an income stream. I'm only interested in building the trust value.
Yeah, just creating a trust, it depends on the type of trust, won't wipe out capital gains on its own. But it's something, it sounds like an upper-level question, Tony. I absolutely encourage you, you know, to call us off the air and give me a few more details.
Yeah, maybe I ought to come in and see you.
We offer a free consultation. Absolutely, yeah. Come see us. Because it depends on some of the details. But you're not wrong in thinking.
I have a lot of details, and I don't want to discuss them over the air.
I understand that, and a lot there. But you're right on point that the trusts, one of the primary purposes for trusts is oftentimes to mitigate taxes, and there very well may be an opportunity there.
Yeah. All right. That's all I want to hear. I think I'm going to have to make arrangements and come in to see you.
All right. We look forward to it, Tony.
All right. Thank you very much.
Have a great day. Have a great weekend.
Great job on the radio, by the way.
I appreciate it, and thanks for listening.
Right, bye-bye. Too bad you're not on every week.
Hey, maybe we can do something there. Thanks,
okay,
Tony.
Bye-bye.
That's a good way of pointing out that there are as many types of trusts as there are fish under the sea. Well, maybe not quite that many, but there are a lot of different types of trusts, and it really depends on the situation. But Tony's right in pointing out that one of the main types of trusts that or group of trusts are trusts that are designed to minimize taxes. Just a reminder again, you've been listening to 1160 WIBM Inside the Law. Jake, do you want to run through quickly some of the upcoming stuff we have? We've got about 2 minutes left here, so I want to at least get – we have 1 minute left.
Let's
do a quick run through, and then we'll say goodbye to everybody.
We will be back on the air. Mr. Novy will be hosting on August 30th. That show will cover the importance of pre-planning your funeral. And our guest for that show is Valerie Morton. She is a funeral director with Anderson & Campbell. And on September 13th, our next show after that, Jason will be back on the air covering LGBT and complicated marriages. And our guests for that show are Cheryl and Esther Daniel, who are, one is an attorney, they're a mother-daughter combination, one is an attorney, and one is a social worker. So that should be a very interesting show.
Should be very interesting, very popular area of the law because it's changing so much. So thanks for listening this morning to our third installment here on Fiduciaries and Trustees. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ocean and Monmouth County, and the rest of the world listening on WOBM.com. We hope you've enjoyed today. I hope everybody caught my Robin Williams shout-out at the beginning. Rest in peace, Robin. We really thank you for all the laughs. Have a great weekend, everybody. Stay classy, New Jersey. Thanks for stopping by.